with us on a journey into the unknown, the unexplained, and the unbelievable. We will test your senses and challenge your beliefs. A world where science and religion clash. Or do they? You will meet real people and hear real stories, but you will not believe. You will witness strange sights and hear strange sounds, but you will not believe. This is the New England Ghost Project. Welcome to the nightmare.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Ghost Chronicles International. I am Ron Kolick, your host, the gatekeeper of the realm of the unknown, the unexplained, the unbelievable, New England's own Van Helsing. With me is my co-host, the gold standard in ghost hunting, the god of infrasound, Mr. Steve Parsons.
Hello, you sound far away.
I do?
You do.
Ooh, I'll have to speak closer then. And we had a rough start to the show. For some reason, my Skype is out, but I'm on a cell phone, so there you go. Joining us today is, let's put it this way. I've been dying to get an anthropologist on the show, so I finally was able to connect with someone. And she is now joining us today, and her name is Elizabeth Wise. Elizabeth, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello there.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
I wanted to start in, we have not everybody deals in science, so they don't know all the sciences really well. So would you let the people know what an anthropologist is exactly?
Okay, sure. So anthropology is the study of humans, and it's actually a fascinating field in that it's split into different groups. So like a cultural anthropologist is someone who studies living people of various cultures. So you could think of this as like a person who is going to go to a different country and study a different tribe or so of living people. A physical anthropologist, also sometimes known as a biological anthropologist, studies the biology, which includes the evolution of people. So, for example, this might include early human ancestors like Neanderthals, but it also can include our closest living relatives, like the African apes. So that's a biological anthropologist. And then an archaeologist is an anthropologist who studies the culture of the past. So that might be through artifacts like, the pyramids or the Sphinx, or something as little as an arrowhead, or it might be looking at historical sites like Jamestown in the Northeast where cannibalism occurred. But it's basically looking at past cultures. And then there's all sorts of in-betweens, right? So, for example, what I do is I'm a bioarchaeologist. So I study the biology of past peoples, in a sense. I look at skeletal remains of humans from the archaeological record to try to reconstruct what their lives were like, in a sense of, were they malnourished? Were they well-nourished? How long did they live? Whether they had diseases, but also what injuries they endured and so forth. So that's kind of a big summary of what anthropology does.
Yeah, but it's a very good summary because, a lot of people don't know exactly what an anthropologist is. They just group it all together in this one grouping, like in a lot of sciences as well. So it's good to distinguish between the two of them. So
we also have here in the UK, a colleague that I've worked with, a paraanthropologist.
So I believe that might revolve around interests in cryptozoology. if I'm not wrong, would that be a paraanthropologist in the UK?
No, I believe that Jack actually studies, well, it's anthropology from a paranormal perspective. It's
okay,
not
so
related to cryptozoology per se.
Okay,
so we're talking about Jack Hunter.
Yeah. So I would say that, yeah, so paraanthropology would be like the study of maybe of the supernatural.
Exactly.
From
exactly.
an anthropological perspective. Okay, yeah. And then cryptozoology would include like Bigfoot.
I've got a question, if I may, because it relates to your field of bioanthropology mm-hmm. or bioarchaeoanthropology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a question that's kind of topical, and I hope this is not going to cause any offense, but lately we are being made increasingly aware of differences in sex and gender, and this being arguments that this is a natural part of our evolution and is long-standing within our biome. How does that relate? I mean, is that in the record, or is this a novel new feature?
So my perspective is that you can split this into two aspects, sex, which is biological differences between men and women and humans. I'm just going to stick to humans now, not any other species. and gender. And gender is the concept of how people display their femininity or their masculinity. So gender, in a sense, is not biological, but sex is. And anthropologists, for some reason, I'm not sure why, and I have my guesses, but they seem to want to erase sex or replace sex with gender. And so one of the things that I, one of my last conference papers was about how if you're looking at bones, skeletal remains, you can determine sex, and that's either male or female. But that, and I think the title of my talk was "Bones Are Binary, But People May Not Be." So, and then I talk about how even though we can tell whether a person was male or female by looking at the bones, it is possible that they didn't identify it that way. Now, for the most part, I think that the varied ways of identifying, you know, if you're thinking about like individuals who are identifying as trans, or so, I think this is all modern. I'm not saying that there wasn't some, you know, little blips here and there in specific cultures, but it wasn't a universal phenomenon. It wasn't a historical phenomenon, but anthropologists for some reason are trying to go back and say, oh, this happened in all these different cultures, and then European colonialists came about and started to erase these multiple genders. I don't believe that. I do think that if throughout human history and prehistory, we couldn't figure out who was male or female, we wouldn't be such a darn successful species. So I do think that the whole, you know, sex is on a spectrum is a completely new phenomenon, and that there were, you know, a smattering of exceptions in historic or prehistoric times, that it was a smattering of exceptions, not the norm, and that the norm is that there were males and females. And if you think about it, sex is binary. It's male or female in humans I'm talking about. But gender is what I would call bimodal. Almost everybody from now to thousands of years ago identified as either male or female. But there were little blips that would be in between, and therefore it's two modes, but not completely binary. But that's gender, not sex. And so then some people will say, well, you know, what about people who are born with a variety of different chromosomes for, instead of XX or XY, like XXY or XYY? And my answer is that is pathological. And pathology means disease, of course. And so what we get is people who are born with pathologies, and most of these individuals cannot reproduce, cannot have children on their own without intervention. And so we cannot consider this a new sex or intermediate sex. And I don't think that's a strong argument for the fact that sex wouldn't be binary. Sex is binary and gender is bimodal.
Can I interject something here?
For a long time.
I think that's been very succinctly put.
I'd like to interject here something here in reality. Uh-huh. And when we are studying, not we, but you as an anthropologist, study bones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference between a female and a male is noticeable, correct?
It's noticeable, yes. Yes, it is. And it's noticeable from the pelvis, of course. But what a lot of people don't realize is that those differences between male and female are differences between male and female are found from the skull all the way throughout the skeleton. So, for example, one of the things is that when people do a lot of, like if you're doing a lot of physical activity, of course you get stronger muscles, but you also get stronger bones. But how the bones change between males and females is different. So, for example, we have what is called muscle markers. And muscle markers are literally where muscles attached on bone, and therefore it causes a raised ridge on the bone. So if you look at a humerus, or you can see the deltoid muscle cause a ridge on the bone. In males, most of the bone changes are on the outside of the bone diameter. And so you get an increasing size of the bone diameter. So if you think about this as like if you were looking at the radius of the bone, it becomes bigger in males and where the muscle attached more prominent. Whereas females, when they're working hard and they have changes, the majority of the changes are on the inside of the bone, right next to the medullary cavity or the marrow. And so their bone does not continue getting more rugged looking. It stays smoother. And therefore, we have this very different way of making a strong bone, but it's obviously different between a male and a female. And these things are controlled by hormones.
So, and when you study the bones, I mean, people say, well, you're making assumptions that this was a male in the past. Where how do you get your reference from? Is it from modern day bones?
Very good question. Basically, what has been done is the reference samples have been from forensic samples where individuals were identified as male or female upon death, if it was early forensic samples. So forensic samples are individuals whose either the bodies were never claimed or the bodies were donated. And so some of these are, you know, from when, for example, people who were homeless and didn't have families, didn't claim the bodies, they used to be sometimes used for forensic studies and end up in samples, skeletal samples that are considered what we call known age and known sex samples. So we knew when they died what sex and age they were, and therefore we can use that then to try to determine how to make these decisions based on other skeletal samples. And so, for example, if you look at the pelvic differences between males and females, this is a universal difference. It doesn't matter if you look at a forensic sample from the US, the UK, a prehistoric sample from Native American Californians, or a sample from some of the earliest hunter-gatherers in South America. It is a universal difference between males and females. And so although there are population-based differences, there are also differences that cross populations, and that's what we use to determine who was male or female.
Okay, that makes sense to me. You choose Steve, I'm sure, right?
Oh, absolutely. It clarifies a lot of the, I think, a lot of the modern debate, and I think a lot of the proponents on either side, particularly on the side that promotes gender above sex, would benefit from listening to what Elizabeth is saying.
Right.
I think it's interesting that we've gone from accepting that males and females can do a variety of things without having, females sometimes want to do male-like things, and males want to do female-like things, or feminine things, and females want to sometimes do masculine things. And we've accepted this as individual variation and human variation, and now it seems like when we find something that doesn't quite fit the exact stereotype we think it should, then it must be transgender. And I think that is kind of insulting, say, well, if you're a female and you like boy things, and an archaeologist digs up your grave, then you must have been trans. Why? It just doesn't seem to compute to me.
Well, haven't we always recognized that, when I was a child, we had books the famous five books, and one of the characters, one of the female characters, was a tomboy. She liked to do what the boys did, but she was very much a female. Mm-hmm. And so this is something, culturally, we've always accepted. There were effeminate males and masculine females.
Yes, but something that we should continue to accept instead of trying to push on some very strange gender ideology.
I mean, some of the arguments that I see, I'm trained, I have medical training, and some of the arguments I see, I kind of recognize as being, well, I was going to say mental illness that's being... in terms of these illusions or delusions, rather, that people can identify as dogs, cats, cakes. Never to feed the delusion.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'll stop right here for a second. In this show, we're not here to discourage or insult anyone or ourselves. We're just trying to bring an understanding of the biological, if I'm using the proper word, differences between males and females. And to me, all this new stuff is more result of our more of a psychological, I don't know if that, it's more, yeah, more of our consciousness than really our biological. In other words, when you're biological, you identify that skeleton. That skeleton is a skeleton. It has no brain, it has no nothing, it's just a skeleton. So it's identifying itself as either male or female. So other people, consciousness is what's changing us, I think, the way we look at things.
I do think
disagree there, Ron.
I do think that, and I'm not a psychologist, of course. I was married to one, but I'm not a psychologist. And so I've been to a lot of psychology conferences. but I do think that there are some people, I would say, who have mental disorders and mental trauma that may be trying to alleviate these through changing their sex. I've read a lot of narratives of especially women who want to be males, and many of those women were sexually abused. And I think that this is, you know, one of the things that should, you know, that psychologists should definitely take a look at, because I do think that there is, and there probably are many psychologists who are taking a look at it, but I do think that there is some kind of correlation between hating your body and having been abused sexually. The number of times I read that kind of narrative is quite outstanding. You know, so I do think that is an issue. But if you look at the bone, going back to the skeletal remains, one of the things we know is that we can identify when in past people, if they were, for example, underwent things like castration. So, for example, the castrati of the Italian singers, right? Operatic singers. Mm-hmm. And we know that when you look at individuals who had undergone those things in historic times, we can identify that through the bones. And if you then look through prehistoric remains, we do not find such examples.
Okay.
Which suggests that was a very rare, odd cultural thing that happened just during that, you know, the singular time, in a sense, or that, you know, a handful of times again. So we don't see patterns like that in prehistoric samples.
Would we see those similar traits in the remains of, for example, eunuchs?
You might, yes, because what they have is they tend to have pelvis. So the pelvic.
We're gonna take a break right now. I'm sorry. You're listening to Ghost Chronicles. We'll be right back after the following messages.
Welcome to TogiNet, radio with a cutting edge.
Do you have a paranormal event, book, or something else you want people to know about? Then why not advertise it on Ghost Chronicles Radio? With over 150,000 downloads a month, get your message out to an audience that's interested in the subject. We have a plan at a cost that fits your needs. For more information, contact Ron Kolick at anyghostproject@comcast.net or call 978-455-6678.
Located in Illinois, there lies a sleepy little town where nothing is a common occurrence.
You going to that party in town tonight?
Heck yeah! I only turned 18 once.
That is until the night of celebration.
Where the hell is she? Oh no. No, 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 Jessica! What? Happening?
From the creators of Shadowhunters, Bite Me, comes a tale of primal terror and grindcore mayhem. Shadowhunters, kill Jessica! Kill!
Thank you.
And hopefully you're still with us. This is the second half of the first half of tonight. Well, at least our guest is. Tonight's 2-hour Ghost Chronicles special edition with, following is it The Next Generation tonight? I don't know.
Yes, dear.
There we go then. And my co-host tonight is New England's own Van Helsing. This is the gold standard.
I love saying that, don't you?
And our very special guest is Dr. Elizabeth Weiss. Is a bioarchaeoanthropologist. I think I've got that bit right. I hope I have.
Yes. Better than me, I'm sure.
It's a shame. We need a paralinguist, actually, because to find out why Ron can never say people's names properly. But as we went into the break, you were talking about the differences, even after you were talking about the castrati, and I'd asked about whether that was also similar to eunuchs in the... and then the outbreak came and kind of cut you up a bit.
Yeah. And so, yes, you can tell the difference, like, between with the eunuch, because what you have is you have the hip bones still reveals the sex, but then there are patterns along the long bones, like the legs and the arms, that show differences with growth patterns, because growth is in part controlled by hormones. Mm-hmm. So not only can we tell, like, the eunuch, castrati, but also some of the pathologies, like Klinefelter syndrome, Turner syndrome. So we can identify when something has gone awry by looking at the bones. Now, obviously, we can't do it every time, because sometimes we don't get the whole skeleton. But saying best case scenario, we have the whole skeleton, we should be able to. And on top of that, we have advanced far enough that we can look at the DNA in bones and look at the chromosomal patterns.
Right. I've got a curveball question.
Okay.
Because, and it relates more to the parasite of things, because that's essentially the core of the show. Mm-hmm. We do see an awful lot of media reports, social media reports primarily, with astonishing claims that bones have been found, or that are in our past, our development was affected or intermingled with non-human species, alien species.
You read my mind, Steve.
Is there any evidence in the bone records of this, or is this just, make believe by people who...
I have not seen any DNA evidence to suggest this. I think there was one article that purported that there was non-human species or alien species in DNA, but I think was most likely contamination, and that was quite a while ago. I can't remember the exact year, but I do remember reading something like that and thinking that something went wrong.
I mean, that people claim that these abnormal skulls.
But yeah, that was exactly where I was going next.
Yeah. blood groups. The O negative blood group is sometimes reputed to have an alien origin or a non-human origin.
I don't think it does. I haven't seen anything that convinced me that any of the blood groups have an alien origin. So, but let's talk about, and of course, I'm not a molecular anthropologist, so I will say that, but let's talk about the skulls, because that is something that I do know quite a lot about. So skulls are extremely malleable when you are growing up. That's how the baby gets through that tight birth canal. And so we can shape the skull quite easily through a variety of techniques. We actually have the artifacts that are linked to this shaping. So in certain parts of the of North America, we get what we call a cradle deformation, basic cradle boarding, where you basically have a very flat skull because mm-hmm. of the being tied to a cradle board. But then in other places like South America, you have the elongated skulls. And actually, if you look at my Twitter account, which is at eweissunburied, I'm holding an elongated skull from Peru. This is done through wrapping the skull starting early on, like literally when the individual was an infant. And we know this in part, it's a couple ways. One thing is we have found infant mummies that still had their wrapping. But we also know that the skull is very malleable. Nowadays, medical doctors will prescribe rounding helmets to prevent the skull from becoming too flat from lying on the back all the time, mm-hmm. for example.
Yeah.
So this is what these elongated skulls are. Now, some people have said, well, oh, these individuals had much larger brains. I'm not convinced of that. I have talked with some people who do believe that. And I said, I'm happy to look into that, but I haven't seen any data that convinces me of that yet.
I was going to ask about brain development with skull deformation, particularly elongation, because there would be a very large cavity, and one would presume either the cerebral spinal fluid would expand to take up the gap, or the brain itself would expand in some way. But would that just
the other thing is the bone would get thicker.
Or the bone would get thicker.
Oh, that would make sense.
And yeah, I was wondering whether that would affect mental capacity.
And you know, I don't know how it would affect mental capacity. And I would be very interested to look into these things. And I have actually offered my services to people with samples, but I have not been yet to these samples. Here's the thing. If you look at South America, one of the interesting things we find is that there are sites where all the young people, 90% of the young people will have deformed skulls and none of the older individuals do, which mm-hmm. suggests that this was a cultural fad, right? So now why did they follow this cultural fad? I don't know. That's another interesting question to ask. But the other thing we know is that in some sites, those individuals who have elongated skulls have earlier deaths, which does suggest that this practice was not good for them, and have an increased rate of what we call trepanation or trephination, depending on your mm-hmm. preference, which is boring holes or cutting holes into the skull to release pressure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which would also suggest that this practice was not very healthy. I think one of the quite interesting things is that when you look at remains from around the world, you see almost many places have skull modification of some sort or another. And some places where this continued on into historic times, such as in the northwest coast of the Americas, let's say British Columbia, Alaska, the tribes really saw those who did not have their skulls modified as barbaric and therefore okay to enslave. So we do have historic examples where this practice was done for very specific cultural reasons, mm-hmm. and people who had not had this done were looked down upon. What's even kind of more or another wrinkle in this is the only continent where we don't see skull modification is Africa. We don't really see a lot of skull modification in Africa, but ethnographically, so in living populations, we have a lot of scarification rituals, and we have teeth changes, so teeth filing. So this does suggest that humans are kind of prone to wanting to change things in order to, and oftentimes in order to distinguish themselves from other tribes.
In Africa, though, we do have neck elongation, don't we?
Yes, neck elongation. That's another example. Yes. So they have these other things, neck elongation, which actually is the pressing down of the collarbone to, which makes the neck appear long.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to mention one other thing. I mean, has there any, you mentioned that you offered your services and it was never taken up or whatever. Are there any notable anthropologists that have studied these and have published papers for peer review?
I have not seen any that have addressed this issue in that, in this para sense. And this could be for several reasons. One, nobody could have done the study, right? But the other thing is that it could be that nobody has done that, those kinds of studies with, through a paranormal lens. Another possibility is that they have done so and it didn't get published. So I'm not, you know, I don't know of any that have looked at it systematically in a manner that would be comparable to other research on skeletal remains.
Another interesting thing that we often see related to the paranormal are the existence in our early cultures of giants.
Steve, are you reading my mind? Every one of those thoughts that you brought up came from mine. When you took over, my friend, you stole my mind.
I can tell you that a lot of the photos on the internet of giants archaeological sites are hoaxes.
Is it Cyprus or Egypt? Israel, where they found very large weapons, which they've attributed to as evidence of giants.
I can't remember, but there's two aspects of that. One is that people create things not necessarily for actual use, right?
Exactly.
So that's one of the things. But if you look at the the biological evidence of what of giants, you would not be able to just literally increase the body size without changing proportions. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, like, your femur couldn't hold the big body, right? You know, or things like that. And
that
so all of the giants,
they just looked like they'd scaled up the picture.
They just scaled the picture, and that's what they did. So now there,
but we do have anomalies, though. We do have giants in our culture now. I mean, you look at we have people that are only 4 foot tall, and we have people that are 7 foot tall. So
there's absolutely variation. So and some of that is normal variation, and some of that is pathological. So a midget, for example, a dwarf, that would be pathological, right? Because it is a variant that is not normal and causes other problems. So, for example, when you
Robert
look at
Wadlow,
the most
common... is one of the most well-known of the giants, isn't he?
What was that? I'm sorry.
Wadlow was at the opposite end of the scale, wasn't he? Just touching 8 foot.
Yes, and then you have these people who are exceedingly tall, usually from a growth hormone issues, and so there are pathologies or variants that are like that. A lot of times, these individuals had other health issues, and it would not necessarily lead to a population of giants, so to speak, right? So these are anomalies. And so, but we don't get people, we have, I don't know of a single person that, or a skeleton that is like 16 feet tall, right? Okay. So you get like to 8 feet. And a lot of times that is exceedingly hard on the organs, on the yeah. heart, for example. And so it is considered a pathology. And you have sometimes, like if you look at certain populations of island populations or very isolated populations, you sometimes will get a cluster of individuals who have the same pathology because of inbreeding. And so we do have examples like that. And there's a type of dwarfism, for example, that is very common among the Amish because of inbreeding. So there are those kind of variants, but I think that that would be, there's a difference, I would say, between gigantism and giants. And gigantism is a medical term for individuals who are above normal height.
Right. But even in our normal heights, I mean, we talk about normal heights. I mean, you know, my mom was like 4 foot tall and my father was 6 foot tall. There's a 2 foot difference there. And yet they were just normal people. There was no, you know,
a lot of human. Yeah. And there's a lot of human variation.
There is a variant, right? There is a variant. So yeah. How do we have a mean or an average of like, you know, the normal human is 4 foot to 6 foot.
We do have averages. You know, obviously the standard deviation or the variance is great, but so for like example, the U.S. is very diverse, right? So you could look at the U.S. The average female, I believe the average is now like 5'3" or 5'4", and mm-hmm. the average height of a guy is like 5'8". And that might seem very short for the U.S., but it takes into consideration, you know, like the fact that we have a lot of shorter individuals from shorter populations. But even if you then look at like, oh, well, there are people who are 6'5", it's still within the normal. And I would say that there's two or three ways to tell whether this is normal variation or a pathology. And one of the ways is it affecting other organs? So like the 8 foot tall person is likely to have other organs greatly negatively affected, like the heart. Mm-hmm. Then the other aspect is there a reason that, that the height, for example, was exaggerated or not achieved. For example, we have iodine deficiency as one reason why people do not attain their genetic height, right? Their genetic potential and height, I should say. But the other aspect is that you can look at growth hormones, and some people who have pituitary tumors, which affect their hormones, will continue to grow. But this will kill them if that tumor is not removed. Mm-hmm. So, and you sometimes see these individuals who have the excessive growth in their hands and feet and chins, for example, as examples of kind of gigantism related to a pituitary tumor that eventually killed them in historic or prehistoric times. Mm-hmm. So there's normal variation, which is great in humans because humans, A, have a large population, but also evolved in many places and therefore had different pressures on them. But then there's pathologies, which is a different story.
As a society, are we whenever we visit historic sites here in the UK from the medieval period, we see low, short height doorways, and we're always told that in Tudor England they were much shorter. As a population, are we actually gaining height at the median level? Are we becoming taller?
We're not becoming taller anymore. We did for a long time, and this is in part because many people never reached their genetic potential due to childhood illnesses, due to malnutrition, parasites in the water, you know. Yeah. So that's a huge reason why people were shorter in the past. If you look at North America, what's interesting is that if you look at many populations of prehistoric samples of, like, let's just look at, California, one of the first collections I studied, the individuals were so tall that they had to cut out sections of the boxes so that their femurs would fit in the box, would fit, right? So the ends of the femurs would be out of the box. And these were individuals who were from a prehistoric hunter-gatherer California population in an area that was rich with resources, but not a lot of people, therefore disease was probably low. And you have this in multiple places in the Americas, in North America especially. And then when they adopt agriculture, they actually get a dip after a few, you know, after like a generation or maybe 20 years or so, they get a dip in height because they start getting more densely populated, coupled with the fact that their diet is not as varied. And then they later recover from this dip, and likely due to a reintroduction of foods that they had initially abandoned when agriculture was not perfected to the extent that they could do both. And we get a recovery of some of that height. So height is a very interesting thing, that it is, there's a genetic potential, but it is very susceptible to the environmental pressures as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know we're getting down on the end of the show. I do have one quick question. Uh-huh. I did happen to see something today, and I did not have a chance to read it fully, but I was wondering if you heard anything about that the African root thing is now under question, whether, you know, we supposedly originated in Africa, all humans, humans. Have you heard anything about that, or was it?
Yeah, I have heard something. I have seen that. The question, I think it is undeniable that humans, not as our species, but humans as the separation of apes and humans, occurred in Africa. So we have all of our very early stuff in Africa. Our earliest in the genus Homo is in Africa. But there is definitely a question of whether our species first came from Africa. And I think that this is a question that is still unanswered. I personally I'm placing a bet on Africa. I think that the data, there's more data to support it than not, but I'm not unwilling to change my mind. And there is some evidence to suggest that, that there, the origins of Homo sapiens may have been outside of Africa. So I think that that's where, you know, and some of this revolves around, you know, even the definition of Homo sapiens. For example, some people say Neanderthals are Homo sapiens. They'll say they're subspecies of Homo sapiens, but others will call them the same, that a completely different species. And so some of it is kind of this academic pedantry of trying to decide where do we actually start as a species.
Very good. And, you know, we hear a lot about the early Neanderthal and the how that the disappearance of as well.
They didn't. So, they went to live in Drake.
Thank you. Thank you, my friend. But I mean, is that even that's under a lot of scrutiny right now, isn't it?
It is, because if there is some suggestion that Neanderthals interbred with Homo sapiens, and we definitely do have Neanderthal genes in our modern population, the question is whether those Neanderthal genes came from Neanderthals or from the population before, which we would call Homo heidelbergensis or archaic Homo sapiens. And not everybody is in agreement. And of course, we don't have the DNA yet of Homo heidelbergensis. So more to come, I'm sure. But this is a fascinating question, whether Neanderthals went extinct or whether they interbred with us, and therefore, in some ways, they're still around within us.
We are coming towards the end. If people are interested more in your work as a bio-archaeoanthropologist, how can they reach out to you? How can they read some of your papers? How can they find some of your conference presentations?
I have a website, and I cannot remember the website link.
We'll put a link.
If you go to Twitter at Eweiss Unburied, the website link is there, and therefore you can find it that way. My husband has just pulled up my webpage, Elizabeth Weiss 74. .wordpress.com.
Fantastic.
Okay. I got to ask you a question. It's actually kind of, when I really first came to you, you were in relation to the skeptic wise.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that question.
We got to go. That was timed perfectly.
I think so too. Anyways, we got to go. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Bye. Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye.
From ghoulies to ghosties, long-leggedy beasties, and things that go bump in the night, deliver us, good Lord.